Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next, an hour dedicated to amplifying the voices of marginalized and underrepresented communities across Western New York and Southern Ontario.
We cannot erase, we cannot reform, we cannot make things better if we're uncomfortable having tough conversations,
Absolutely.
If we're uncomfortable
Absolutely.
Talking about race.
What's Next carries forward our mission to engage in meaningful conversations about race, equity, and the shared concerns that deeply affect Buffalo's East Side and beyond.
Don't stop. Make those families part of your life. Their lives are part of yours. Don't stop.
Together, we dive into the real issues, striving for understanding, connection, and change.
In the suburban area, everywhere, we must work and teach our children.
From Buffalo, Toronto Public Media, this is What's Next. My name is Jay Moran, and today we continue our series on 514, looking back and maybe perhaps looking forward. Our theme today, policy, advocacy, and systemic change. And with us, India Walton, former mayoral candidate, of course, here in the city of Buffalo, former common council candidate, and now senior advisor with Roots Action. India, good to have you back.
Nice to be here. Thank you for having me.
Most certainly a pleasure. And because I think this week of all weeks, if there is a time for serious talk, it's this one as many. And with that, we've laid out the theme, advocacy and systemic change. Have we seen any change in 3 years?
We've seen lots of change. I don't know whether it's the change that we wanted. We have new interim mayor. There still isn't another full-service grocery store in that two-mile radius around the Tops grocery store. And, you know, there's just still so much work to be done.
If you don't mind, maybe just take a step back. If you don't mind going back, we've had these conversations with a lot of people about their experience of 514. Mm-hmm. How about for you? What do you recall from that day?
I was at my son's baseball game.
Mm.
And I got a call asking where I was because there was a shooting on Jefferson. And they said it was a mass shooting. And I said, that's strange because, you know, black people don't really do mass shootings. That's a statistical fact.
Yeah, I think that's serious.
And they said, no, 10 people, somebody went and shot up the grocery store. And then my phone just started going off and people were saying, where are you? Where are you? You need to get down here right now. So I left Shoshone and I went down on Jefferson Avenue, and just the scene there was like something out of a horror movie.
Yeah, I appreciate you stepping back with that. And it was part of the many realizations that have come out of that experience for me. It was the mental wellness of community members. Talking to people in the counseling community, mm-hmm. overwhelmed with people seeking counseling in those days after. What about now? What do we see healing, at least, if nothing else?
I think there's been a concerted effort to highlight the need for mental health care, to try and make it more accessible. But I think that as a nurse, right, a holistic approach, some of the reasons why people are unable to heal is because we still have not figured out how to provide basic needs. We still have high rates of unemployment, houselessness. People still don't have access to fresh food and even accessing mental health services, even though we've sort of broken down some of those barriers. It's not easy for a lot of people because it's so stigmatized in our community.
I mean, you raised like a large array of issues just within that answer as well. Are there simple things? We're talking, like you said, a holistic approach. And so with that, you know, you can maybe focus on one thing and, you know, another thing becomes a larger issue. But are there simple things that should have been done in these last 3 years to address some of those issues?
I believe so. I think that adopting and implementing good cause eviction is one of them. I think that doing a better job with proactive rental inspections and not allowing people to charge exorbitant amounts of rent would be helpful. I think that a local minimum wage ordinance might be helpful. I mean, there are lots of ways that we can begin to solve for these problems. And I mean, like in 2021, we had a platform that addressed a whole host of these issues, right? Encouraging cooperatively owned businesses and community ownership of land and self-determination. I mean, our city spent 65% of our American Rescue Plan dollars on filling budget holes instead of implementing real solutions that could have had a real impact on the lives of everyday Buffalonians, not only on the east side, but all across the city.
But at the same time, it is worth, I think, always keeping a certain focus on the east side. I mean, if this time working in this program has shown me just that, things that individuals like yourself have brought to my attention regarding the neighborhood. And I want to try to stay focused on that in that regard. Let's turn it like this for just a moment. We can talk about what could be changed. What are the strengths? What are the strengths of Buffalo's east side?
The strengths lie in the people, right? The Crossroads Coalition last month rolled out a pilot of a universal basic income program. The Downroot Fund is supporting small businesses with grants and capacity support. They're also figuring out how to get some civic engagement dollars onto the ground. People in the community are still doing great work, community care, mutual aid, and I wish that we could elevate people who really care to positions of leadership so that we see that translate into lasting, sustainable policy change.
People who care. Why aren't people who care being elevated?
Because we don't play the political games. And sometimes you get more done outside of that system. It's slow, bureaucratic, and it's hostile to Black people, especially Black women.
At the same time, though, when it comes to voting, mm-hmm. we know it's important. We saw it in the national election, for sure. There's no doubt about that. What about the vote inside the East Side community? What makes the difference there? Now, you had great success, of course, in your mayoral campaign as well. But what can make the difference for a candidate who really wants that vote?
I think being on the ground, being accessible, I think that folks are more likely to go out and vote, number one, and go out and vote for a candidate that they feel like they have a personal connection with. But I do think that voter turnout is still extremely low on the east side. And that reason is because no matter who we voted for the last, how old am I? I don't know how long I've been voting, 20-something years, we've not seen the material conditions of our community improve. In fact, they've gotten worse. Under the tenure of a Black mayor, we've not seen any real investments in the East Side. And every time there's a request for something, they tell us to be happy with what we have. And that's unfair. We deserve the same things that everyone else in this community has access to. Swimming pools, public space, well-maintained parks, infrastructure, decent housing, a good education for our children.
You mentioned the former mayor, Byron Brown. Of course, he was your opponent as well. Would you say that with the current budget situation, we're maybe seeing a little bit of a revisit to his tenure and to his legacy as well?
I mean, this is the other shoe dropping. This is 20 years of running on not raising taxes when he probably should have. This is 20 years of tear it down instead of repair, rehab, rebuild, and put it back on the tax rolls. This is tax breaks for wealthy developers and being beholden to donors. So, yes, this is definitely his legacy.
What do I know the one thing about you, you're always talking to people. People want to come out and they want to talk to you as well. And they want to either they want to pick your brain or they want to fill your brain. What are people saying when it comes to the Brown legacy? What are they saying that maybe they weren't saying publicly a few years ago?
Yeah. Folks are, well, first of all, I'll say this. There are a lot of people who are still, like, if Byron Brown were to run for mayor today, I think he could still win.
Hmm.
I would say that his approval among the general public is not that terrible, but that's because we have a vacuum of information. There's a gap in what people know about what's actually happening in city government, who's responsible for what, and all of the things behind it. However, for those folks who pay attention to politics, to the state of the city, a lot of people are disappointed. A lot of people from his administration and from his camp are disappointed.
Disappointed in what way?
That he left this community in this state.
We're talking with India Walton this morning on What's Next here on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR. I'd like to, you know, I think you told me before, you're not looking to run for office again. That's something that you've done. That's an experience I think that has enriched you, but also it's probably hardened you a little bit and left you with more than a few scars as well. But you took a good hard look at City Hall and city government. Mm-hmm. What are some of those things? Like you said, there's a vacuum of information that people don't understand about their government. Let's talk about some of those things. What jumps out to you?
So I was at a local pub a couple of weeks ago talking to someone, and I said, you know, there are still lots of people who don't even know who the interim mayor is.
Hmm.
And she said to me, well, we should do a person on the street type of thing and see if this is true. So I was actually at the University of Buffalo last week with students, people who are in college, college educated folks, and asked them who the interim mayor was, and someone said, some guy named Mike.
Sorry for laughing. I shouldn't be laughing.
But I mean, if we start just there,
right?
If you don't know who the mayor of your city is, the second largest city in New York State, do you know who your council person is? Do you know what the job of a council person is? Do you know who your county legislator is? Do you know what the job of your county legislator is? That is one of the issues that we have on the East Side community. Because when something is wrong, who do you complain to, and what are the steps that you must take in order to get action for your issue?
Wow, that's an amazing anecdotal piece of information there for sure. So let's get back into the city of government. So in a way, you're kind of, you know, we're putting on trial a little bit the electorate, right?
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, there are structural elements inside city government. If people don't know the name of the mayor, they don't know how city government works. They don't know how money is being spent inside city government. I believe the projected budget for the next year is, $622 million. That's a lot of money that's going to be spent on city services. What are people missing?
They're missing services. I mean,
right.
You know, trash pickup, snow removal. I mean, I think that people are missing now this conversation about the potential privatization of public institutions like Klein Hands, the Buffalo Zoo, you know, and that is going to continue to create structures that will leave so many people out. You know, we are looking at another tax increase on top of reassessments that have increased the value of lots of homes on the East Side that people are not going to be able to afford to keep up with. So where is the policy out of our legislative body working with our state legislators that are going to be able to keep these people in place, our elders, our folks who are on fixed incomes and are not going to be able to afford these tax increases? How are we keeping them from their houses being foreclosed on by the city?
Well, that's a lot right there for sure. Interesting about housing, though. I think the last time I had a chance to talk to you, and we didn't get a chance to talk about this, you went to Vienna to take a look at what you thought was a sustainable, affordable housing model.
Mm-hmm.
I want to talk about that a little bit, because that's come up a couple of times here, but nobody's really been able to get into that. What did you see when you went there?
I saw beautiful, well-maintained social housing with tenants who were organized in mixed-income, quality amenity housing. I mean, folks are living in housing where no one pays more than 30% of their income on housing costs, but there are saunas and pools on site. There are children who can walk to kindergarten on site. There are grocery stores within walking distance, and the people are happy. But what I will say is that what I noticed about Vienna is that it's a homogenous nation.
Sure.
And when everyone is the same, it's easy to justify everyone doing well.
Mm.
And in a place like Buffalo, that's segregated, that has major issues with race, this is about 514, it's difficult to justify. If you ever go into the comment sections on the news when there's an affordable housing project or any type of development on the east side, every comment is about, they don't deserve that, they're just going to tear it up, you know, and we have to get away from believing that certain people are not deserving of good things.
We know that all people are deserving of good things, mm-hmm. but like you said, it's not necessarily a common, I'm just thinking of a conversation I had yesterday, it's not necessarily it was a common conversation, but at the same time, could you see that plan that you saw, that reality in Vienna? Could you see it? Could you see that being installed on the east side and, well, for that matter, other parts of the city of Buffalo, which also need affordable housing?
I absolutely can. And Emily Gallagher, who's an assembly person from downstate, traveled with us and has a social housing package of legislation that she's put forth. So I think that these things are possible. And that is the reason why I would love for folks to sort of like get out of the Buffalo bubble and consider things that are being done in other places. We don't have to keep doing things the way we've already always done them because they don't necessarily work.
At the same time, of course, as soon as we start talking about the projects, cost comes with it. Is there a solid argument or reality, maybe that we're just missing, that this could be, with the types of resources that we're already allocating, this could be a reality?
It could. And I've always maintained that Buffalo doesn't have a lack of resources. We just got bad priorities.
Mm.
Right? Like, you'll sell Nick Sinatra a piece of prime real estate for a dollar. But when we were working in the Fruit Belt in the land trust, in order to build affordable, sustainable single family homes, we had to pay market rate for the land. Make it make sense.
Right. Right. And that message is not getting through to you?
I don't think it has.
And what about the, so we have a mayoral race going on.
Mm-hmm.
Do you see these concerns coming to the forefront in any way whatsoever?
I have attended a few of the mayoral forums, and the questions from the audience allude to concern about housing. A lot of people are saying they really don't want a whole bunch of apartment buildings. People want single family homes. They want home ownership. They want to be able to have an asset in their family and create and build generational wealth. And I still don't know that we've solved for that. And there are projects where, you know, it's so heavily subsidized that, you know, a moderate income family needs a $200,000 subsidy to afford the house. And now I'm getting into the wonkiness.
That's all right. That's one of the reasons why I wanted you to come here, because I know this is where you live.
And one of the things that my thing is you talk about where the money is coming from. But when you subsidize these homeownership programs and there's no shared equity or subsidy retention, then you have to come up with that same subsidy over and over again for each person rather than recycling it in the way you would with something like a community land trust.
Right, right. And again, like you said, a little on the wonky side, but worth having, right? I mean, again, a vacuum of knowledge, a vacuum of information. Yeah, that was your term earlier in this program. So let's see if we can't just fill in that a little bit more. You talked about Assemblyperson Gallagher from downstate who has, where could we maybe find out about her? I was probably at her website. What'd you say? Was that stuff available?
Yeah, I would say on her website, you can go to housingjusticeforall.org. You know, follow me on social media. I'm always talking
about...
And
you're pretty lively, I might add.
You know, so... Yeah, I think that we have to do a better job, and I also have to do a better job of explaining very complex concepts in a way that people can understand and get behind, because it works, right? But then we have the battle of the narrative, where when we talk about things like community land trusts and shared equity housing and co-ops, people say, well, that's robbing me of the wealth that I would be able to acquire. But you're not acquiring any wealth now.
Right.
Right. You got to start somewhere. And the intention of a CLT home is you don't need to stay there forever. When you are on your feet and when you have a stable, healthy, safe place to live, it's easier to go back to school, to start that business, you know? And when you are on your feet, go buy a house on the market if that's what you want to do. But we want to keep that house affordable for the next person who needs a hand up.
We're talking with India Walton today on What's Next, a Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR. You know, great information here, great perspective on possibilities, which I love hearing. At the same time, you know better than anybody that you can have great ideas and yet also be, I mean, personally backlashed. I don't even know if that's a verb that I just utilized there, but, you know, personally assaulted, at least in terms of reputation. What's that? What's at the core of that, would you say? I mean, I'm asking to revisit something that might be something that scarred you, but hardened you, but also probably made you a wiser person. What about that? I mean, where does that come from?
It comes from racism and misogyny. But then it also comes from this desire to enclose and maintain power and wealth. And when we look at what is happening right now on a national level, this is not about black and white. It's not about Democrat and Republican or independent. This is about money. This is about the oligarchy. This is about millionaires and particularly billionaires robbing the people of what it is that we work for and what we deserve.
We're coming down to our final minutes here, and we did want to come in and talk about 514. How about hopes for the community here? I mean, we've kind of outlined some policy elements here for sure. What about for the people of the East Side, the people of the community around the Jefferson Avenue Tops who go by that store every day? I know there are still people who won't go by that store, will not go in that store, obviously. I know there's a lot of folks still like that. Well, what are the hopes? What are your hopes for the community?
My hopes for the community is vitality and unity. I think that there's a lot of hurt and pain. Our children are lashing out against one another. I want to see us have some sense of real autonomy, self-determination. I want to see development come from neighborhoods and communities where they are deciding for themselves what they desire, what they want, and what they need. I would love to see the Humboldt Expressway restored to its former glory as the Humboldt Parkway. And, you know, a closure of the racial wealth gap. I want all of those things for my community.
And we are in the middle of a mayoral race. How about for the candidates? They want the East Side vote. They want India Walton's support. What do they need to do?
Come talk to us. You know, stop assuming. And one thing that I said is that those of us who you label as activists are not your enemies. I don't want to be at City Hall. I don't want to be at a protest. I don't want to be angry all the time. I want to relax. So like, let's just have a conversation and work on some solutions. Like you said, we have, there's great ideas out there that with a little bit of support and education, we can find the resources. You know, they're, like I said, the Crossroads Coalition went out and got a $10 million commitment all on their own to do work in the community. Imagine how much more powerful that could be if we had the cooperation of our city government.
And how about just, you've kind of outlined it again. You've gotten to a lot of different things here. So now your message to the people of the east side of Buffalo. What's your message to them?
We are,
again, not candidate India Walton.
Not candidate India Walton, but we are strong. I mean, we survive some of the toughest things that any city can go through, and we can't quit now. So get out and vote. It does matter. Pay attention to what's happening around you and do your part, whatever that may be. And we have to take care of each other.
And you're going to continue to be active?
I don't have a choice.
Do you ever regret running for mayor?
I don't.
Really?
I do not. I think that it matured me in a lot of ways. It gave me an expansive and wonderful network of people that I've been able to keep in touch with, like former Senator Nina Turner out of Ohio and Jamal Bowman. And I've been able to travel the world and country and work on congressional campaigns. And I was able to go to the Democratic National Convention. And it opened up a world of things that I never would have been able to experience had I just stayed a nurse or even stayed a local organizer.
India Walton, of course, ran for mayor of the city of Buffalo, won the Democratic primary, and also ran for a common council. She now works for Roots Action as a senior advisor. India Walton, as always, it's great to have you here with us on What's Next.
Thank you so much.
Coming up next, Naila Ansari-Cotilla talks with John Tory and Leighton Jones. This is What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
In a world full of noise, you need a station that cuts through the chaos. That's us. WBFO is now Buffalo Toronto Public Media NPR, a new name, but the same trusted news, NPR programming, community connections, and in-depth reporting you count on every day. We know change takes a little getting used to, but you can rest easy knowing that everything you love about this station is right where you left it. BTPM NPR. Listen anytime on BTPM Listen or btpm.org.
You're listening to What's Next, our place to discuss the important issues of our communities of Western New York and Southern Ontario. We want to hear from you. Click on the Talk to Us option in the BTPM Listen app, and we will work to get your questions or comments on the air. Do you have a story or concern that we should be addressing? Email us using whatsnext@btpm.org. Together, we'll have the conversations that are needed. This is Buffalo Toronto Public Media, NPR.
Hello, everyone. I'm Naila Ansari-Cotillo, and you're listening to What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media, where we explore the challenges, progress, and voices shaping our community. Today's conversation is both solemn and necessary as we approach the anniversary of the May 14th tragedy, when a racially motivated massacre at Tops Market shattered lives and exposed deep systemic wounds. We ask, where are we now? We'll discuss Buffalo's response in terms of policy, reparations, and the political climate, what's changed, what hasn't, and what justice really looks like for Buffalonians, particularly on the east side of Buffalo. Joining me today, I have two powerful voices and friends, Leighton Jones, who's a leader in our community with Buffalo, Our City, Action Buffalo, leading advocate and community center policy change maker, and Dr. John Tory, who I have to say congratulations, now associate professor of philosophy and Africana studies at Buffalo State University, whose work focuses on ethics, race, and reparative justice. Thank you all for being here.
Thank you for having us.
Indeed.
It's a pleasure.
It's with a heavy heart, but in some ways, you know, change comes with pain, as they say. And so, Leighton, I want to start with you. As someone on the ground organizing daily, what does Buffalo feel like today after May 14th? And has the city lived up to its promises of change?
No, Buffalo is not in a great place right now. I would say Buffalo is definitely in almost the same place it was when 514 happened. And so if a white supremacist was supposed to want to target a city in the same instance, they could do the same thing to Buffalo again. And that's unfortunate to say. I say this with a heavy heart, understanding that the community still feels so much trauma when they go to Tops, understanding that there is not many options still to this date for food accessibility on the east side. And when we think about all the promises that have been made from the governor, Kathy Hochul, from City Hall, from the mayor, all of these people, the president came here for crying out loud, and all of this attention, mainstream, was here promising actual investment in the east side. And where is it today? That's still a question mark.
Yeah, it seems a bit performative. Like when things happen, everyone's there, cameras are rolling, mm-hmm. all the folks come out, you know, people from the suburbs all around the country. And then you go back today, and I don't know that we still see those people.
No, what we have to show for it is a monument. And I can't say that's something that family requested, right? Mm-hmm. Like, I can't say that this is something that the community wanted. This is not something that they thought to be an investment, right? And so this is an issue that we keep getting gifts and things of this nature in the capacity that it's not impacting people's lives in a real way. And so how do we go forward is we have to be clear about our demands. We have to be clear about who it is that these things are serving, right? Because as you said, it's just for the presentation of it. Mm-hmm. It's not creating any real sustainable change. And when we talk about equity and bringing Black people or the east side of Buffalo up to par throughout the rest of the city, that's not the case. That's not happening right now. So real investment needs to happen, and we have to look to our elected leaders for that. But we have to be clear about what exactly we want. And when we say that, we then hold them accountable to that.
Absolutely. Dr. Torrey, from a philosophical and historical lens, how do communities process such trauma with systemic issues remain unsolved? Is healing even possible when structural change hasn't happened?
It's going to be a much slower pace and a slower rate. You can think of it as if you've got a knife in you, you got a stab wound, there are ways in which you can heal faster or slower from the wound. We are not healing very quickly from this wound. And frequently when communities of color have been traumatized, particularly Black communities have been traumatized, there are a wide variety of responses that come, that from justifiable anger to a need to build stronger community bonds, so you start rallying around each other. Sometimes the need for performative responses so that it can be seen that this is something that can't be just ignored or overlooked or treated as day-to-day business, like this is what's regular. But in order for things to really heal, the institutions have to acknowledge the harms that have taken place and whatever responsibility they have in allowing or encouraging, perhaps, those harms to take place. Without that kind of recognition, it's tough to heal. You know, if you're in an abusive relationship and the person doesn't acknowledge that they're hurting you, it's tough to recover from that relationship. Mm. And we're stuck in a similar sort of situation here where, you know, harm has happened. And much to Layton's point here, we've got some virtue signaling going on that we have to show up and perform and make it be seen by mass media how terrible a thing this is. And then walk away 2-3 months later and we hear years later and nothing much has shifted. So healing requires not just investment from the community, because the community's already been wounded. They're looking for the investment to recover from the harm. Mm-hmm. The investment now has to come from those who have more resources, access, and ability to acknowledge and shift policy where possible and culture where necessary to try to, again, to bridge the gaps that exist that allow for a racist wild man to come here from hours away and do some murder.
It's so interesting because you talked about taking accountability. Do you think we've actually taken accountability in terms of administration, in terms of City Hall, Albany saying, well, because of the ways we've set redlining, let's say, or the ways that we've positioned the city, this is why this was able to happen, right? Mm-hmm. Because we acknowledge there's an accountability in the sense of we saw what happened, and there's this notion of there's accountability of white supremacy, right? We can acknowledge this was a racist act of terrorism. Mm-hmm. But do you feel like the administration, our current administration in the city of Buffalo, the state has actually acknowledged their positioning on it? And that goes to both of you all.
No.
I'd go no, but I also with the caveat that we have had an administrative switch in City Hall since. So, you know, perhaps the upcoming mayoral election, we'll see if future candidates and or people from City Hall will articulate more of what the view should be or what could be done. But certainly we haven't gotten much either way.
Mm-hmm. Well, the switch, are you talking about like the current administration that exists?
Yeah, just that. We went from Brown to Scanlon. We don't know what's coming next, but regardless.
Right, because I was going to say the Brown to Scanlon switch is not necessarily a switch to me personally or specifically, right, only because he has been a part of the council for the past 12 years. So he has added to these decisions that have negatively impacted the city in this capacity. And like, to even that point, right, why I would say they even aren't being accountable is because when we think about like redistricting, and redistricting happens every 10 years, right? That happened 5 years ago now. And when it did happen, you can see in the maps how they drew them, and they intentionally did that and kept the Black community stuck in this one place, knowing what has happened. And so it's unfortunate that we have to think that as a city, knowing how or where we stand, and we can't be accountable and try to actively change the harms that we've done to the community in this capacity. It's wrong. And we have to come to a point where we can speak truth and light to the harms that we've done. We have to acknowledge that we've done it, like you said, because that's how healing starts, mm-hmm, right? So, no, I wouldn't say that we've done enough to be accountable.
And I'll take it back to you, Layton. There's, you know, there's a lot of talk about like never again, you know, addressing segregation and economic disparity. What concrete policies do you feel like have been enacted? Yeah, I know it might be a no, right? Or where is City Hall and Albany falling short in terms of this whole concept of like never again, this is going to happen in Buffalo. We're going to protect Buffalo. We are going to protect the east side of Buffalo. And, you know, you started out saying that this can actually happen again.
Yes. I would say the only thing that has changed is that Kathy Hochul has introduced like a gun reform, mm-hmm, act. But would that prevent this from happening again? I can't say that, right? But what I can say is that it does add some protection when it comes down to how people can access gun in New York State specifically. So shout out to that, mm-hmm, when we want to think of something positive. But policy change? I wouldn't say that the city of Buffalo specifically has had any real positive policy change. That's one of the things that I think this administration or City Hall in general, they have the opportunity to create policies. And this is one of the things that they lack, right? We have the charter. We have all of these documents that create laws that we then abide by. And this is written into practice for generations to come, right? And so this is the point of having leaders in our city, is to change the trajectory. That isn't happening, unfortunately. So we need to encourage that to happen more often than it is happening, because things and times are changing, and the laws that were 5 years ago are not relevant for today. Mm-hmm. So we need to move on.
Quite literally, even literally. Today with a whole new administration in terms of a president, you know, we're in different times.
Yes, and you can see even how this administration nationally is using that leverage to change policy because they see how it works. So if we can see that on a national level, we have to take heed on a local level to say this is how we can protect our neighbors.
Absolutely. And we often hear about this term resilience, and I'll go to Dr. Torrey on this. And I would say Black folks, Brown folks, we are always resilient and have always been resilient.
Yep.
Is it enough to keep kind of pushing on being resilient on these systems that remain unjust?
I'd say yes. You're getting beat in the head. That's how you know you're resilient. You're taking shots and you keep getting back up. A thing we do want to remember is not everybody's going to keep getting back up. Mm-hmm. You know, there's only so many shots we all can take, because whether you're talking your body, your emotion, your spirit, your energy, whatever it might be, there's only so many times you can get kind of browbeaten before your legs give out. One of the good things about community is we can help you prop your legs up and keep you resilient. But leaning into resiliency is perhaps one of our weapons in the case. Is I suppose not to be using no doggone gun reference after you say we get
please.
Oh Lord, of all the things, you know, an arrow in the quiver. It's an arrow to use, but it might not be the main one we use, because mm-hmm, it means we're sending people out to get thumped. and they're already getting thumped by the day-to-day life because they're living unprotected. They're living unpolicied with policy that doesn't help them or improve their situation, and with government structures that are already ignoring them. We're already utilizing that resiliency arrow over and over again. We got to build more arrows so that we don't burn out the resiliency arrow. I hope that makes some sense.
No, it definitely makes sense, because I was going to go to Layton, because in terms of resiliency, you're on the ground. Our City Action Buffalo is on the ground, and that is a form of resilience, but there also has to be these other initiatives that have to help. One thing can't just function on its own to make change. So how, as a community, do we take that resilience that we have and help to build policy change, or, you know, get our, you know, politicians to be able to push for these changes for our community?
I would say a big part of that is building relationships and real connections, right? And so one of the things that I really love about OCAB is that we have started to really go out into the community to ask these questions. How can we help? What is important to you? These questions are important because that's how you know what the community wants. If we say we're wanting to be the community's voice, that's how you get to be the community's voice. And when you think about these Common Council elected leaders, we have to think they have a constituent. They represent their constituents. They're not representing themselves. They're representing a whole body of people. And so are they doing this work of going into the community and finding out what are the priorities that our communities have for us, for us to lead with, right? And so I would say that's where we get a lot of our resiliency from, because the community puts the ammo in our back, right? They keep us on par. They tell us what to do. They tell us where to go, and they tell us how to do it and how they want it done, right? And oftentimes we're held accountable by them if we're not doing something that they do not appreciate, right? And so I think that's how that relationship is supposed to work, but that's where you get your energy from, is by the people, for the people, and listening to the people, because that's really how we can make a real impact in our city.
And I do appreciate the organization also engaging with politicians, because sometimes it can be very like anti-politician, anti, you know, anything government. But I have seen politicians, when you spoke, that come have shown up and say, okay, they really are at the kind of the ground level with the ear, with the people, what they want. And so now I'm seeing politicians kind of engage with you all, which is really nice to see.
Listen, the major thing about being a C4 organization that I can appreciate is that we can endorse politicians, because there's always this part of organizing that I often dislike, is that we want to say, oh, no, we can't allow for the power to be a part of the power structure, right? But the power structure is important because that's who is making the decisions. Mm-hmm. So when we think about who's making the decisions, we want to be a part of the people who are electing them, right? So when you support a person who is with the people, you then get people results, right? Mm-hmm. And so that's what we're looking to build, is that, listen, civic engagement is just as important as activism, and that's where it all stems from. So as much as we want to say we're an organization and we're living up to the people's standards, we also have to say that we have the politicians behind us that are backing what the people want.
Absolutely.
You know, civic engagement, to me, is a form of activism. This is the kind of stuff I tell my students on a regular basis. If you want your democracy to live, you have to participate. That's how you get to hold people accountable. From the endorsement ability to who you're voting for, to who you might campaign for or help out with or donate your money to. All of that counts as your responsibility. If you want this thing to work, you've got to kick in.
Yeah.
And so that's one of the dope things about what y'all do, is the community holds you all responsible like your electeds almost.
Yes.
So a reminder for all of us that we also have to hold our electeds responsible because we're their community. You know? And so that's the relationship that you've got is the, that's the proper relationship to have from representative to community. Mm-hmm. And so consider that a model version for what you have to do. You know, you all are doing like the town halls that people are doing for all intents and purposes, you know, trying to find out what is needed for the people and how we can get it done.
Yeah.
And if anything, I imagine you see there is no singular black voice. There's a multitude of approaches, and it's trying to figure out how to navigate the lava so it's all going the same direction, as opposed to kind of spreading out everywhere, going haphazardly.
And this is how like people can make educated choices.
Bingo.
That is the main point, right? Is because we see all of these politicians and we know that they're on the ballot, but do we know what they stand for? Mm-hmm. Do we know what they're going to put into policy? Are they going to take care of us?
And it's interesting you point that out, because in terms of looking at the recent presidential election, it was a big disparity between educated people and non-educated people. And that necessarily doesn't always mean college, right?
It doesn't.
And I think that that's a point that we have to look at in terms of advocacy and change, is that we have to educate our community and we have to educate our people. And that doesn't always mean you having to go to college and taking a civics course to understand that. Dr. Torrey, I want to go back a little bit to reparations, and I want to look at funding. Mm. So sometimes folks think of investments and they think of philanthropy as a form of reparations, but is that a true form of reparations?
No, it's really nice that they do it. But reparations has to come from those who have caused the harm to actively try to repair the harm. If someone else wants to step in because they saw something bad happen and they feel bad and they want to make sure to put their bid in, that's a wonderful thing. But that's not reparations. That's not the reparations policy. That's not reparative policy. That all has to come from institutions. When you see cities, states, municipalities put forth reparations policies, they're not asking for charity to help get this across the line. Other people can participate with how they like, but reparations is to be done by the institutions that have caused the harm to help the victims or the descendants of those victims. Philanthropy is just another, it can be another way to virtue signal at its worst or at its best. It's a nice way that we can get resources that may be getting withheld from city, state, or federal governments.
And what does reparations look like? So it's systemic. So say we have, I know this is a deeper, long research. But if we can start to look at, so folks can really understand, because you're really explaining what reparations is and what it can be. If we look at these institutions and say, okay, this is what we want on the east side of Buffalo. This is what happened after May 14th. It doesn't necessarily always have to be financial. Financial helps, mm-hmm. right? But it could be in looks of community centers. It can be in building Absolutely. And having a strategic plan. Do you think that that is what's happening? Do we have to demand that, Leighton?
Even, I think, New York State recently has been looking into an initiative to create what reparations could look like for mm-hmm. African Americans.
They do have it.
And I'm not sure where the progress is, because there's a lot of conversation being had around how that money comes down to being distributed. And I think that's where a lot of the issue lies. But is that happening on a city level, on a local level? No. We are not getting invested into in the capacities that we should. The city of Buffalo does understand that the East Side is below the poverty level nationally. And when we think about that, how are we investing then into this community versus the other areas of this city? And that investment is not happening. When we think of like equitable, I don't know if people understand what that word mm-hmm. means, but it's not like a bridge. It's not like this ladder, right? It's like literally bringing up the class of people so they are at the standard where everyone else has been.
Right?
Like, it's not just like giving them this lump sum of money and then thinking, oh, they're going to do well with this. No, it's like being intentional and understanding that these people have been like for generations undermined. And so we need to bring them up to a place where they can succeed and they do feel valued. And then we can expect for the city, the community to be a safer place, to be a more thriving place, to be more welcoming to all. Mm-hmm. But until that happens, people will continue to disassociate the East Side as if the East Side is this forgotten part of the city, which it is.
Right. And it's interesting because some states are kind of pushing, you know, first time home buyers and we're going to give you $100,000. You know, there's people are doing this work. And so we have to figure out what that looks like for us, mm-hmm. particularly on the east side of Buffalo.
So most of the versions that we've seen nationally, they won't include any direct payouts because, my God, it'll get too messy. And no one wants that political grenade in their hands to say that we're going to sign off giving money out. But right. what people have signed off on in general has been some sort of either re-education. So we want to make sure that more people know about Black history more effectively and more accurately. Redistribution of wealth insofar as can we get resources into the community spaces. So mm-hmm. things like community centers, things like increasing I keep focusing on education because that's where a lot of the backbone ends up going is in either an education or in, say, home ownership. Or, again, resources. Think about repairing the harm as what kind of resources have we lacked that we can pump into the community.
Yeah.
So if we have a food desert as one of the harms, because that's one of the reasons why 514 could happen, then perhaps having more grocery stores would be one way to repair that harm from this version of trying from the institutions locally who think they may have had a hand in setting up the redlining and the impoverishing of the east side of Buffalo, well, we can try to add in more resources, like you said, bring the floor up to where it's supposed to be.
Yeah.
And I do think we have to be creative when we're thinking about reparations, because we live in, you know, Trump 2.0 was real. This isn't 1963. This is 2025. We have a very different environment politically, socially, and culturally than what we may want to have or what we should have. As a result, we're going to need to be creative to try to figure out what's going to get across the line. We need to be pragmatic about what's going to be helpful to get the communities that require assistance to where they need to be. We may have to abandon, you know, I want it alls, because I'd like to get some things.
Yeah.
You know, I want it all, but I don't want my kids' kids to be screwed over because I shot for everything and we got nothing out of it when I know I could have got them something that would raise their floor. And these, I think, are the kind of decisions that have to get made in real time.
True.
As we're trying to figure out what, not necessarily the how, but the what does it mean to have these harms be repaired? What do we actually need? What resources are required? The distribution part, and who's going to get it, everyone's going to be salty about that because it's black people. But when we have an idea of what we want in a very concrete manner, it's easier to make those demands stick, particularly if we're putting them at the feet of something like justice.
Before we close out, I'd like to ask each of you to give some of your thoughts. What does justice look like for Buffalo in 2025 and beyond? I'll start with Layton.
What does justice look like? Justice looks like systematic change where we are not over policing black brown communities, and we are not allowing for police to get away with hurting black and brown bodies on a consistent basis. Justice looks like ensuring that every member of the community is being kept safe, not only through policy, but through direct action, right? And so one of the things that I love that you point out is that people need to understand and be educated on what these things mean, because justice means a lot of things, right? But I personally do not think that we can get justice for 514. Because we can't, personally, I don't think you can get justice for death, right? That the justice would be reclaiming that life and having that person walk on earth again, right? So what justice means to me is that people are being held accountable for the acts that they do, and ensuring that families are being respected to the point where they feel that they have moved out of the place that they were when the trauma happened. That's what justice means to me.
Dr. Torrey.
I like that. Moving out of the trauma ideas is really important to me. When I think about justice, quoted from Rodney Roberts for almost a decade now, setting an unjust situation right. Justice in the aftermath of injustice, which clearly this is a horrific, unjust event that we're still talking about years later. It's how can we set the unjust situation right? That's what justice requires. To me, that's the standard. There's your floor, there's your ceiling. Your floor is changing the unjust situation. Your ceiling is making sure it doesn't happen again. Mm-hmm. Some people have views that you don't need the ceiling. I think we need the whole room. If you're going to set the situation right, that also means we're not going to redo the injustice again. We have to be intentional about what that looks like and how to do it. So what does justice look like here? How are we making sure that black people on the east side of Buffalo aren't living in unjust conditions and aren't being victims of unjust policies and are being propped up by just systems that distribute the goods, the benefits, and the burdens of society to black people like we deserve to have, as opposed to just the burdens and the harms.
For our listeners, how can they be involved? How can they help to make justice?
Read. Sweet Jesus, read. And don't just read these people on the TikTok. I love the TikTok. Yeah. It's a fantastic thing. But do your research. And that don't mean do the Google. And that doesn't mean read to the AI. It means you have to have a little bit more common sense and patience. Learning takes time, folks. If you're not learning, you're not growing. And we need growing, learning people to help participate.
And we need learning people because the mayoral elections are coming up 2025. What should our listeners be looking for in a candidate?
Policy. Candidates need to have a way they're looking forward. right? Because when we think about what a politician is championing, that makes sense to people. But oftentimes they have to go low to like, what are the basic needs of people? Because that is what's getting them traction. But also, yes, I can understand we need the basic needs of life, but we also need policy. How are you going to make sure that not just me and my generation, but how does the generation after me prosper? So I think I look forward to seeing what it looks like for any of these candidates.
Well, thank you, Leighton Jones and Dr. John Torrey, for your insights and tireless work in the community as we honor those we lost on May 14th. Let us not just have a remembrance of them, but a recommitment to action. To our listeners, What's Next is up all about us. Stay informed, stay engaged, and as always, stay hopeful. I'm Naila Ansari-Cotillo, and this has been What's Next on Buffalo Toronto Public Media. Until next time.
Support for WBFO and What's Next comes from our members and from Health Foundation for Western and Central New York, where racial and socioeconomic health equity are prioritized. Learn more about building healthier neighborhoods at hfwcny.org.